this year has evaporated. We did a quick review at our dress rehearsal of everything the orchestra has played this season that feels like all of Western music. It was a big year, and we're so grateful to all of you for being so supportive and being such a the most important part of it for us to share this music with you. And our season finale tonight is a huge program. We gave it the incredibly generic title, Romantic Expressions. However, Berlioz would really appreciate that title. No one was more romantically expressive. No one had it more as their irrepressible goal as an artist than Berlioz. He was not trained early, like so many great musicians. He was not a child prodigy. He was not destined for his career from birth. He was self-taught, in fact, against the wishes of his family that wanted him to be a doctor and sent him off to school to study to be one. He tried, but couldn't resist his calling. When he was a kid, he taught himself to play the guitar and the flute. He mastered the elements of harmony and music theory on his own, and elbowed his way into legitimate musical school and study with actual professional caliber teachers of his own irrepressible spirit and will. And thank goodness, because if this person had not had an artistic outlet for his personality, his emotional state, and his obsessive, compulsive relationship with people, I don't know what would have become of him. Berlioz was a true original. He was a man before his time, a man out of time. If you think about it, he was born in 1803. Isn't that right around when Beethoven 5 and 6 were being written? So he's in his 20s, right around the time Beethoven is at his absolute peak as a composer and about to die. And here comes Berlioz, who pushed the envelope of expression and music more than you can imagine right away, when we were still kind of, you know, a foot and a half in the classical era, and not, you know, we named these eras later, right? And not in the romantic self-expression era just yet. But what Berlioz did against all odds was not only become a pivotal composer in his time, wildly misunderstood by his colleagues and peers of the period, but he also became a conductor, because the music he wrote was almost unplayable for most orchestras, and the only, oftentimes the best vehicle for a success was to conduct it himself. So that means he also developed the orchestra's abilities, just generally, all over Europe, wherever he conducted. And he was a music critic as well. That's how he earned a living most of the time. And he advanced this ideal of his that music must be expressive, must be dramatic, must have a story and a statement. And often the stories of his life are truly unbelievable. What you'll hear in the music, his incredible, long, uniquely shaped melodic writing, the rhythmic drive in the music that's really unusual, and most especially the wild and unpredictable harmonic changes in the music, these are all reflections of a rather complicated person. You probably, many of you may know, he was very obsessed with a young woman, a Shakespearean actress. He was also obsessed with Shakespeare. Harriet Smithson, his obsessive love for her was the idée fixe of his great work, the Symphonie Fantastique. And his behavior to woo her would nowadays have him under a court restraining order. He rented rooms next to where she lived. He would ambush her in places where she was going to perform. He would try to get people to take her somewhere where he could go find her. Amazingly, they did marry. Didn't last. When they were on the outs, he was on the rebound with another woman. He was like 26 and she was much younger. He had just won the coveted Prix de Rome. Prix de Rome, and he had to go to Italy to study. So he was separated from this girlfriend, fiance. And while he was away, the fiance's mother wrote to him and said, "It's off. She's fallen in love with someone else. And I am not kidding you, he plotted a double murder-suicide.
Whoa.
He traveled from Paris, from Rome to back to Paris. He had gone so far as to create a disguise with a wig. He was going to go in as the chambermaid. He had a weapon. And he was going to carry this off. The stories vary. Some stories say he thought better of it. What am I doing? Why would I do this? Some stories say they lost his luggage when he was changing carriages. I mean, whoa. So a couple times in rehearsal, I've been, you know, there are some very unique passages, especially in the basses and cellos where they have these big accents. And I now realize the metaphor I should have been using to get that accent. It should be literally like stabbing the belly of someone and gutting them, you know, right there. I mean, he really wanted the extreme in expression, from not just loud, but also soft, and not just obvious, but also subtle. And the Roman Carnival Overture has a little bit of all of that in it. It's mostly just a really fun piece. None of this murderous rage is in there, although you might hear it in that place I described. You'll hear the coloration in the percussion, the use of the tambourine, the triangle. You'll hear those wild harmonic changes that I talked about, where they change literally every eighth note in a particular passage near the end. And most especially, you'll hear the music from his failed, amazingly, at the time, opera, Benvenuto Cellini, now a masterpiece. We all recognize it as such, but in his time, totally bombed, and this was devastating to him. He plucked some of the themes and material and put it all in this overture, most famously the big aria sung so beautifully by our English horn soloist, Jeannie Brown. It is actually the duet between our hero and heroine in Benvenuto Cellini. I'd like to play it for you, and you'll first hear the soprano singing of her love for Cellini, and then you'll hear the two of them in a duet, and this is almost exactly quoted in the overture. Here's the music from Benvenuto Cellini. So, Tchaikovsky, a little bit more stable person. And a word about his second symphony, subtitled The Little Russian. There is no big Russian. The Little Russian does not refer to a smaller version of a Russian symphony. It is a nickname that was given to the work not by Tchaikovsky, but by the era itself. It acquired this title because unfortunately, as a diminutive term, Ukraine is often referred to as Little Russia. And this symphony uses an abundance of material taken directly from Ukrainian folk song, beautiful, beautiful folk song. Tchaikovsky's second home really was a small town, I can't remember the name of it, Kamenka or something like that, a suburb, for lack of a better word, of Kiev, where his sister and her family lived. And Tchaikovsky never really had a family of his own, so his sister's family meant everything to him, and he spent so much time there that it really was his familiar home turf. And this symphony, as many of you may know, Tchaikovsky was very Russian, because he was, as a composer, but he also studied in the European, Western European compositional mold and really embraced Western cultural musical ideas in his Russian soul. And this was frowned upon by the big five, Mussorgsky, oh crap, Mussorgsky, Korsakov, excuse me, Cesar Kwee, and the two Bs, Borodin and
Valkyrev.
Thank you, teacher, Foster, musician. They loved his second symphony because he used folk song and he maintained the integrity for the most part of those songs and repeated them over and over in the symphony in recognizable ways, and the way he would vary it would be with orchestration or instrumentation and with shifting harmonic language and orchestration around and underneath and all surrounding these tunes. And they would have been very familiar to listeners. So this work really put Tchaikovsky in the approval box of the big five, and it was hugely successful with the public. What I love about it is now we get to listen to this symphony from the future. So we get to hear, oh my gosh, that sounds like the fourth symphony. Wow, you can hear how he's working out ideas for the sixth symphony, even though he doesn't know it yet. And you can hear this very deep commitment to the integrity of the Ukrainian folk song on the one hand, and this very profound understanding of the future in his compositional style, because he's really paving the way for people like Stravinsky and Prokofiev and many others. So I'd like to give you an example of some of the folk songs you'll hear. In the first movement, a solo horn sings out a very subtle variant of a very big, important folk song of the Ukraine called Down the Mother Volga. The mother, Volga, is a river, and it's referred to as mother because it really was the mother to life for everyone anywhere near it, for commerce, for trade, for food, for livelihood. And this is a revered song that, well, we'll have a chorus sing it for you first. In turns at the end of the first movement to sort of bookend the work. And in between, there's an allegro that somewhere there's always a tie back to some content of that melody. The second movement, it couldn't be more different. It starts off as a very, very distant approaching march. It's actually music that Tchaikovsky composed for an opera that never saw the light of day, for the wedding scene of that opera. And it affords him the opportunity to vary this theme in delightful ways, that everything from very large statements in the strings to sparkling 16th notes in the woodwinds. And the contrasting theme, the second theme that you hear later in the work, is another Ukrainian folk song. I think it's called Spin, Oh My Spinner. Interestingly, I was looking for a recording of this online somewhere, and when I type in Spin, Oh My Spinner, Ukrainian folk song, it's a bunch of fidget spinners. Not what I was looking for. But that melody, unlike this very angular, vertical, sort of choppy march theme, the folk song is very lyrical. It's in a minor key. Couldn't be more different. Here are those two themes back to back. The trio, instead of being in three beats, is in two, very cute little trio that the woodwinds begin. And you hear in that trio the genesis of seeds of the ideas of the fourth symphony of Tchaikovsky, where we have short notes sparkling in the woodwinds and pizzicato strings and an exchange between them. And then in the last movement, I have to, before we turn to Elgar, I have to give you a taste of this very well-known Ukrainian folk song of the time called The Crane. Tchaikovsky joked in his comments about this work that his butler really wrote it because, or someone who worked in the employ of the family, was humming and singing this song all the time. And it pervades the last movement. This is a recording of some Ukrainian folk artists on original Ukrainian folk instruments singing The Crane. Expect, you know, this big, big, broad note, and you expect something profound to follow it. And absolutely, it's substance-free what happens next. It's a broken up little onbeat, offbeat, quiet little exchange of short notes. Not what you would expect. He builds that theme, that rising line, up over and over and over again, and then introduces a lyrical second theme that's very different, one of his own compositional origin. This is the second theme. Until we reach what feels like the first of many climaxes, and then the whole thing falls apart with these giant fat notes in the brasses and the wind and the strings and echoing back and forth to one another. Cataclysmic destruction of music. The notes come out of nowhere, they don't make harmonic sense, and we're left completely lost. What follows that moment is he keeps those crazy long notes, but he brings back the crane tune and that second theme you just heard all at once. This is why Stravinsky loved the symphony. Here's that note. Service to it, so.
Yeah, no, but when I first heard the piece, I was a teenager. I went to the Baltimore Symphony, right. And I will not name the soloist, but I sat in the audience and I went, what was that? I did not like it one bit, and I was confused by that because everybody talked about this as being this great, you know, cello concerto. And so I went, I mean, that's a point where some people can just stop thinking about it. But I was curious, I wanted to know why people love this so much. And just so you know a little something about me, I don't stop reading. I was reading backstage while she was talking about Marilyn's, about Elgar, because I like to get into the mindset of those people. So I was listening to recordings of it back then. I was trying all sorts of things, and I discovered the great Jacqueline Dupre recording, the one that she made when she was 16 years old. And I was so taken with it, first of all, because I was about 15 at the time, and so impressed with this piece that I said, now I love it. Okay, I want to know more. I want to learn more. And I was so taken with it, in fact, I became obsessed with her teacher, William Pleath, and a number of years later I went to study with him in London, And my first Elgar Concerto performance with orchestra took place in London, which I look back on that now and I'm like, that's a little bold for an American cellist who's sort of related to Jacqueline du Brée to come into London and be like, here I am with your piece. But they were very nice about it, so.
Yeah, it's been really rewarding for me to learn and grow into the piece more with you, especially, I'm curious to know, I don't want to like stereotype, you know, solo performances, chamber orchestra experience, and orchestral experience, and concerto playing, but these are all very, they're all related, of course, but they're all unique, and you have spent so many years of your career entirely within the chamber music world. I have to say, that sensibility in your playing is so helpful to all of us. The awareness, the situational awareness, and your generosity, and also she came out a whole week early and worked with us a whole week.
Oh, that was fun. That's a treat for us because we don't normally get to do that.
But I'm curious what that is like from your perspective.
Well, so it's interesting. I always, growing up, I wanted to be a soloist. I think a lot of kids, when they start playing, especially if they're driven, as I was very competitive and very driven, wanted to be a soloist, went to Juilliard, was like, you know, went to England to study with Plieth on a Fulbright grant, and then moved back in with my parents. Because that's what all of us dream to do. Sorry, Mom and Dad, over there. It was wonderful. Actually, they're there. That actually gave me time to think about how I wanted to go about things. And it was during that time that I began to play a ton of chamber music. So when the opportunity came to move to San Francisco in 1996 to form a string quartet, brand new, I thought, well, that's interesting. I want to know what that's like from the bottom up. And that was, I thought, I'll give it 3 years. We disbanded in 2016, that's a 20-year run there. And it was great, played all over the world, recorded 20 CDs. In the meantime, I was sneaking out on the side, and it was usually during our vacations, to play a concerto here or there, because I still longed to do that, or recitals. So when the quartet disbanded, I've been doing some teaching, but I've been doing a ton of playing, and to my surprise, a lot of concertos and recitals. So that's been interesting. But I look at everything through chamber music eyes, because, we were talking about this, I think, it's not just about the cello part. It's about how the cello and the clarinet are discussing something. Or there are huge sections in here where the first violins are playing what I'm playing, but up or down an octave. So I'm being supported constantly by them, and it's so exciting, and I love that you'll see me. I try not to look around too much because I get super distracted by everybody's face and how intense they are, but it's so much fun, too. I mean, I'm not just alone up here then, and that's important.
And with this music, too, I mean, I thought about trying to play some examples for you or talk analytically about the piece. It is so organic.
Yeah.
It is so through composed. The intervallic relationships between things, you know, the first halves and last halves of phrases and how they influence the whole work. There's so much to say, we shouldn't even start. Yeah. Just listen to it.
Experience it, right?
Experience.
Yeah. It's a journey because it starts one way and it ends in that same way, but the heroic character has gone through a whole set of things going on there. I think that's part of it. What's amazing too to me, this piece almost didn't survive its premiere, which I think that's so interesting. Such a great work of art was poorly prepared, not because of Elgar, not because of the cellist. There was a political situation going on with the London Symphony where the conductor at the time was trying to show off his own chops and wouldn't give the orchestra any rehearsal time. So they basically sight-read this concerto and it was a disaster.
This is why conductors feel so much responsibility.
Yes.
Or they should.
Well, and I just read last night, see, right before I went to bed, I was reading about my concerto again. And I read that the cellist who premiered it, Felix Salmond, he refused to play the piece ever again or teach it. He actually left England after this fateful premiere, moved to New York City, taught at Juilliard and Curtis, and then he refused. It was never part of his world, even though he was the one who premiered it.
It is so important to be reminded that it's necessary, and sometimes very, very, very important, to hear a piece of music more than one time.
But did you know who popularized it next? Because I found that out, too.
Not Jacqueline du Brée?
No, not. She wasn't until 1965, so this is premiered in 1921, a 19-year-old cellist who played in that initial premiere that went so scandalously bad, Sir John Barbirolli.
Oh my goodness.
Said, this is a great piece, we need to play this again. That's 1921, Beatrice Harrison played it a lot, And then Barbara Early conducted the Dupre recording that we all know and loved so much in 1965. So it's like he was really instrumental in making sure that it's still here today. So I think, I mean, I take that, I've commissioned a lot of music, I've premiered a lot of music, and I think that it's such an important part of the process.
Yes.
That we have to get behind it and champion those works too.
That's something to remember when we hear these works we're all familiar with over music history, that they were new.
Mm-hmm.
They had to be championed. I also wonder, it is not for the faint of heart, this piece.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in this, what you're, the story you've told of its poor preparation and lack of success in the first performance is one thing, but there's also the matter of everyone had just made it through, or not,
yes.
World War I,
yeah.
And the losses and the losses and the losses. And to,
it's about
to reflect on that, it's impossible not to.
Yeah, you have to dive deep into that sort of sadness and regret, which is very much what he was experiencing at this time. He's the last piece he completed, actually, his last big orchestral work, yet he lived till 1934, so this is 1919. That's a long time for a great composer to not write any more music. His wife died 6 months later as well, and that was those two things, the war, and he just couldn't go on. I mean, he conducted and taught, but he couldn't write anymore.
It does make the sunny spots in the music shine through so brightly. And it, talk about shining through, it's been a joy.
Oh.
It's been a, it will be continue to
yes.
be a joy.
Thank you.
The fun part for us is we've been doing this for more than a week now.
Texting.
And now you get to hear it. So it's a process we're so lucky to be able to enjoy with you.
We're kicking out the stage.
We have to go.
Oh, okay.
Well,
yes.
I don't know. Do we? What time is it?
Oh, it's
oh
time
I,
to go. Yeah. Well, we could stay and chat, but we do have a concert to play. And they probably need a moment. So thank you for joining us. And clearly we should just come back and talk later.
Okay.
We'll chat with you.